From KQED Silicon Valley in San Jose, I'm Dave Iverson. The annual malady known as March Madness is now underway, and San Jose is right in the thick of it, hosting men's regional basketball games at the HB Pavilion just a few blocks from our studio. And last night, it was the scene of a big upset. 12th-seeded California defeated Nevada, Las Vegas. And it wasn't even the biggest upset of the night. Think Harvard. In the hour ahead, we'll talk about the men's games as well as the women's tournament, which features stellar teams from both Stanford and Cal. And we'll talk about the differences as well between men's and women's basketball. It's all ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Silicon Valley in San Jose, I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome to Forum. With a minute left to play last night, tiny Davidson College was on the verge of a huge upset, up by six over highly rated Marquette. A minute later, somehow, Marquette had fought back and won. Afterwards, sports writer Mike DeCourcy described the desolate Davidson locker room like this. This is what silence looks like. There are nearly a dozen college kids sitting motionless in a sterile room. None of them moves, none of them speaks. Remarkably, no one cries. Not quite. 2,000 miles away, here in San Jose, there was a big upset as Cal defeated UNLV. There is nothing quite like the college basketball tournament in sports, both men's and women's, and San Jose is right in the middle of all of it, hosting men's regional games this weekend, including that upset victory by Cal last night. College basketball is our topic this hour. We'll take up both the men's and the women's tournament, talk about the difference between the men's and women's games, and what college sports represent. Joining us to do that, Mark Purdy, sports columnist for the San Jose Mercury News and mercurynews.com. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to San Jose.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Michelle Smith joins us as well. She is a contributor to ESPNW.com, which caters to women's sports. She also founded LeftCoastHoops.com, which covers women's basketball on the West Coast. Michelle, good morning.
Good morning to you.
And Ann Killian is with us as well, sports columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and former contributing writer to Sports Illustrated. Ann, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks all very much for being here. Well, let's start with last night's events here in San Jose. Mark Purdy, Cal won, surprise in some ways, big upset as a 12 seed, but that Mike Montgomery fellow at Cal can still coach.
Yes, he can, and I think this Cal team he has this year is kind of frustrating him because they're not, some days they're there, some days they're not, but they're smart enough to know what what the NCAA tournament is in terms of getting their faces on TV. And I think that he had their full attention, and he drew up a really, really good game plan. You know, they played UNLV before the season and lost to them by 1 point. And while the zone defense he drew up, I don't want to get too basketball geeky, but it really stymied UNLV. And, The Cal players, actually, emotionally, were very much there.
Is the role of coaching Michelle Smith particularly important in the NCAA tournament, both for men and for women? Is it a time when coaches like a Mike Montgomery or a Tara Vanderveer, that for that matter, at Stanford, particularly shine?
You know, I think it is. I think it's you're playing, you know, if you're going to play all the way to the end of the tournament, you're playing six games, quick turnarounds. Your scouting reports are hugely important, how you're preparing for what's next. You're preparing these young athletes for a bit of an endurance exercise over these 3 weeks during the course of the tournament. So I think coaching is as important probably during this phase of our sporting experience as any other.
And Mark just said that for once Mike Montgomery had the full attention of his Cal players earlier this season. Of course, there was that famous incident where he shoved his star player, Alan Crabb, something you can't quite imagine a women's coach, whether that's Leslie Gottlieb at Cal or Tara Vanderveer at Stanford, doing. Describe, if you would, some of the differences between the big-name coaches, a Tara Vanderveer and a Mike Montgomery.
Well, I mean, I can absolutely imagine some women's coaches shoving their players.
Yeah, me too.
To be clear, there are very many very emotional coaches in the game, both on the men's and the women's side. It's funny because Mike and Tara obviously were viewed in the same way because they coached at Stanford for many, many years together, and they both managed to recruit very cerebral kids and coach in a very kind of low-key, intellectual kind of manner. And that's why I think the incident with Mike Montgomery was so surprising to those of us who watched him for a long time. It was very out of character. It was very, you know, to see him emotional like that, to kind of lose his composure on the sideline, was a little bit of a shock. And you're absolutely right about coaching being important. I mean, the year-to-year in the March Madness, we kind of forget the names of the players who hit the big shot, or the, you know, we remember what schools make the amazing comebacks or the Cinderella stories. But the players, unless they go on to big NBA careers, and very few of them do, we don't always remember, but we remember the coaches. And if it wasn't for March, guys like Mike Krzyzewski at Duke and Tom Izzo at Michigan State, they would just be other coaches. I mean, people's reputations are made in March. Guys like the new names, like Shaka Smart at VCU and Brad Stevens at Butler, it's because of March that these guys become famous and hugely paid and get, you know, all the spotlight and the attention. And last night's game, I think, was important for Mike Montgomery because it had really been a while since he'd had a signature win in March. It had been since he'd been at Stanford. And so I think that was a big game for him.
I'd like each of you to talk some about what draws you to the tournament, whether it is watching coaches shine in this March moment or whether it's the nature of the one-and-done tournament. I'm a big college basketball fan, but there is something that is particularly captivating about what happens during this time of year. What is it for you, Mark Purdy?
Well, I love the whole college basketball culture, and the whole business with the silly mascots and the students. I mean, the NCAA tournament has become probably way too big, really, but they still manage to get enough students down and pep bands down by the floor to make you realize it's not an NBA game. But in terms of the whole storylines unfolding, what I love about it is it'll happen again today, all right? We got a whole other batch of games today, right? There's some kid out there who nobody's heard the name of. Nobody knows who he is.
Like Robert Thurman.
Like Robert Thurman last night. That's what I wrote about in this morning's paper, where, you know, he spent his whole career, nobody's paid attention to anything. And he's, all of a sudden, he's going to make a big play or a series of big plays where now he's a national figure. And it may only be for this one day. But that part of reality shows on television try to create that stuff. This is organic. This is real. Where, yeah, this kid last night, Robert Thurman for Cal, he's a transfer student from the small military college in Vermont. He walks onto the team a few years ago, and he started two games his whole career, and he's had two double figure. He's 10 points or more in only two games. And last night, all of a sudden, he finds himself in the situation because of the way the game unfolded and the way Montgomery designed the offense was he's a big guy, 6'10", 6'8", and this big, beefy guy, and he's kind of hanging out by the basket, and Cal star players drive into the lane, and they're double – Nevada Olafsvega is double-teaming them, so they got to give up the ball. Well, they give up the ball, this guy. He six times he gets the ball, six times he jumps up and dunks it two-handed. The crowd, because there are a lot of Cal fans around, just keeps louder and louder and louder. And this kid, all of a sudden, is the biggest star of the game, and it's happening on national TV, too. And, you know, 2 hours earlier, he was nobody. And now he's the man. I just love that whole whimsical part of it and just what that does.
Mark Purdy joining us from the San Jose Mercury News. Michelle Smith, what is it for you? What is it that turns you on about either the women's or the men's tournament?
I think it's the stakes. I think it is the one-and-done nature of it. I think it is that teams, you know, this tournament will end and teams will have their team banquets to celebrate the end of the year, and literally the next morning they will get up and they will go to the track as a team and they will start running in April to prepare themselves for the following March. These kids are working all year long. They're working on their games to play in this tournament. There are programs that don't get here very often who will celebrate merely the fact that they have appeared in these brackets. But it is a one-and-done tournament, and so you know, these teams are constantly fending off what ends up being crushing disappointment for the team that loses because their season ends that day. They're a team, they practice, they're together, they eat together, and then at the end of a game, if they didn't win, it's over, they're finished. And I think the kids play for those stakes, the coaches coach, you know, aiming at, you know, that one and done thing. It's just, it's very, you know, the stakes of it make it very intense and very emotional for the teams, and, you know, and I think that's a large part of the appeal.
And it's also, I would think, Ann Killian, at least the margin is so thin and narrow. When I was describing or reading Mike DeCourcy's description of the Davidson College locker room, they were so close, and then it all went away. Or conversely, St. Mary's was so close to pulling off an incredible comeback, and yet in the end didn't quite make it. Is that part of it, too, that it's not only, as Michelle Smith says, the stakes are so high, but the difference between this glorious feeling and this horrible feeling is so slim?
Well, obviously, it is that way in the best games. I mean, there are some stinkers out there, and there was one in San Jose last night when Syracuse just, I don't even know what the final ended up being, but they just ran over Montana. I mean, there are a lot of games where the difference is not that thin, but certainly those are the games that we really remember, the last-minute shots. And last night we're calling Cal an upset, because technically it was, you know, if you go by the seeding, UNLV was a number 5 seed, Cal was a number 12 seed, but Cal was playing 48 miles from home, and was clearly the better team last night. So I don't really know how much of an upset that was. You can't always go by the seedings. The thing that I like the best about March Madness is, you know, we live in a time where sports is such a big business, and it's always the richest, the biggest programs, the ones that cheat the best. In so many ways, both on the professional and the college level. What I love about March Madness is the parity, is the ability of a Harvard to come in and be the story of the day, as well as a sleazy big-time program like Louisville. I mean, it's both the big and the small, the in-between. The kids are from all over. You know, ethnically, they're all different. It's a different landscape than we see too often in sports. We know beforehand who is going to be the victor, who is the team to put your money on. It to a certain degree in March Madness, we know that as well. But really, you can have a Harvard come up big. You can have a little tiny program like a VCU or a Davidson in past years go really far, or a Butler, when Butler made it to the championship game. And that, to me, is the beauty of it. It's the surprise and the little guys taking on the Goliaths and the just, you know, the we don't see that enough in sports. And too often in sports, it's just who's the biggest, who has the most money, and who cheats the best. And I think in the NCAA tournament, that's different.
It's speaking of surprise, I heard two words last night that I never thought I would hear watching the Harvard game, which was the color commentator describing Harvard as being too quick and agile for New Mexico to handle. Yeah, I never quite thought I'd hear that description of Harvard athletes. Let's spend a moment talking about the difference between the men's and the women's game, and whether or not there is something that's fundamentally appealing in a different way. Each of you have referenced something about the sort of purity of the college tournament. Is it even more pure in the women's game? Ann Killian first, and we'll go around on that.
Well, I think to a certain degree, the game is obviously different because it's not played above the rim, and the stakes are a lot lower. Nobody's looking to go to the NBA. I mean, certainly there's the WNBA, but, you know, which is very small potatoes compared to what's at stake at the NBA level. The women's game has changed dramatically in the last 20 years, and programs have found that they can earn a lot of money through their women's programs and be dominant and recruit well and maybe even bend the rules a little bit like is done in the men's programs, but I think there is a little bit more of a purity there. It's a little simpler of a situation. There's not as many the shoe contracts, the $1 million coaching salaries, though there are a couple. There's just not the kind of behind the scenes level of sleaze that you might get in some of the big programs in the men's game.
Mark, how about you on that?
Well,
how do you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably made this joke with Ann before. I mean, I worry that, you know, the women's programs are adopting the worst parts of the men's basketball culture with the sleaze. If the WNBA ever does get big, you'll probably see more cheating and more sleaze in the women's programs. But I think also the atmosphere at women's games is a little different. You don't get the beer drinking, party down people quite as much. It's more, I find it's more of a family kind of atmosphere, and I think more, I don't know, I would say more sophisticated fans, but fans who really are more, this is just my personal opinion, but you're asking me, I have opinions on demand. I think you have people at women's games who actually appreciate, this sounds weird, but appreciates basketball more. I think you know, a lot of people come to the men's games for different reasons, you know, to hang out with their pals and, you know, get. But I think women's fans of the women's game actually appreciate basketball more. And it lends a little different feel to the games. And, you know, Ann's right, the game's played more below the rim. Michelle covers it more day to day. She probably has some more, you know, cogent observations than that. But I do think that. The women are in a good place right now. I suppose they'd like to be bigger, but I think it's in a good place in terms of balancing the alleged goal of college sports to get people degrees and get them through school as well as, you know, play basketball than the men's game, and I like that.
Michelle Smith, I go to more men's games than women's, but what I notice when I'm at women's games, at Stanford in particular, and of course Stanford is really good, but there is a level of enthusiasm about the game itself, both in with the fans and with the players, that somehow feels different. And maybe this sounds like a cliche, maybe it sounds even paternalistic, but there's a kind of genuine sense about it that reads in a different way. How do you view that as someone who covers it all the time?
You know, I think that there are a couple of points there. I think one of them is that, you know, these women are staying in school for 4 years. I know, especially at the top programs in the men's program, they're, you know, we talk about one and done in terms of the players and the players that come in as freshmen and sophomores, and you barely get a chance to know them and invest in them and attach yourself to them and, you know, and their development and their progress before they're gone. In the women's game, you know, these women are staying for 4 years. You have a chance to, as a fan, develop those relationships, appreciate the progress of how much better Skylar Diggins at Notre Dame got from her freshman year to her senior year. The improvement that a player like Brittany Griner, who everybody agrees is a once-in-a-generation basketball player for the women, you know, the development in her game. You can follow that development from a basketball perspective. You can see these young women mature and grow up, you invest in them, you kind of attach yourself to them, and I think that's very different, it feels to me, than in men's basketball. The other issue I would also say is the issue of parity. Ann talked really well about sort of the magic of the men's tournament and the David and Goliath. There is not as much of that as the women's game. The powers are still concentrated at a few, we'll call them the brand name schools, the Connecticuts, the Tennessees, the Baylors, Stanford, Notre Dame. Those are the schools that still seem to get the top players and seem to play at a different level than most of the rest of the tournament. The upsets that make the men's tournament so appealing, especially in the first weekend or two, you're not going to see a ton of those in the women's game, but you are going to see star players who have nurtured that their image and their development over 4 years, and I think that is a huge distinction between the men's game and the women's game.
Michelle Smith, contributor to ESPNW, which caters to women's sports, also founder of Left Coast Hoops.com. We'd like to hear from you as well. What is appealing to you about the NCAA tournaments, both men's and women's? Do you have a preference? Do you follow the women's tournament more than the men's? How do you see the differences between what women's sports represents and what men's sports represents? You can join us and email us at kqed.org, forum@kqed.org, and you can also give us a call. We'd love to hear your point of view on this as well. What storylines are each of you going to be following in the days and weeks ahead? Mark, you talked about the great Robert Thurman story. I'm curious about what else, what other stories each of you will be following. What are you going to be watching for in the next day here in San Jose, Mark Purdy?
Yeah. Wow, yeah, I do have to do that. I need to sit down and think about what I want to write. Well, you know, we got these two other two games here tomorrow. Cal's going to play Syracuse, and as a journalist, you're always thinking the angles. In this case, Mike Montgomery and Jim Boeheim, who's the coach at Syracuse, are actually turn out to be good pals. They socialize with their wives, I found out, and they're two of the oldest, if not the two oldest coaches in the tournament, 66 and 68. So that kind of intrigues me that these guys would hang on and do this. It's such a stressful deal. The other matchup, with Oregon and help me out here. Where they put St. Louis? Yes. How could I forget St. Louis? I wrote about St. St. Louis is the best story in the tournament to me. Their coach Rick Majerus died in December, and Jim Cruz, who actually played on the 1976
Indiana team
that won the national championship, went undefeated, probably considered the best college basketball team in history. He takes over, and now they've only lost one game since the middle of January, and now that if they get to the Sweet 16 and the Final Four, that will everybody in the country will be following their saga. They're also a good group of guys, it seems to me. The players, the journalists who cover that team really like them. So here, those are two good storylines for tomorrow here. On a national basis,
you don't quite have the great Tinkle story.
The coach
of the Montana team and the daughter who plays for Stanford.
Right. Although I guess he now gets to, after losing by 47 points, he gets to see her play this weekend. Okay, I'm sure he wouldn't like to have lost by that many. And I just like saying the name Wayne Tinkle. But on a national basis, we'll get there. I went to a Big Ten school, so I love the Big Ten, and I love to see the Big Ten get three or four teams in the Final Four, and I'll be following that. I do think that Louisville, Ann mentioned the word sleaze associated with their name. I will not argue with that, and it'd be good. How about if we get Harvard to the Final Four? that's the thing. You just don't know. But here, those are the angles I'm looking at.
And I know you have to leave us in a moment, so let me get your take on the story you'll be following, and Michelle will get yours after the break. But Ann, what are you going to be watching for on either the men's or the women's side in the next 48 hours in particular?
Well, I am a long-suffering UCLA Bruin, so tonight I'll be watching my team. But this weekend I'll be at the Stanford women, who host the first two rounds at their building at Maples. And I'll be following them, and I think they're really interesting this year. They're basically, not to put anyone else on the roster down, but they're pretty much a one-woman team with Chinne Agumake. And I'll follow them to Spokane, where they could have an incredible rematch with Cal, because both Cal and Stanford are in sub-regionals that lead right into Spokane, and that would be a tremendous thing, I think, for West Coast women's basketball if Cal and Stanford played each other in the Elite Eight. They've split their regular season games, their conference games, and they have a really beautiful budding rivalry, and I think that would be great, because for too long, women's West Coast basketball has been all about Stanford, which is a fantastic program, but truthfully, a little competition wouldn't hurt. So that's the main thing I'll be looking for.
And Kellyanne, sports columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. And thanks so much for being part of the first part of our program.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be rejoined by Mark Purdy of the San Jose Mercury News and Michelle Smith of ESPNW when we return. We'd like to hear from you as well. What do you think? What do you like about the tournaments? 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. This is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. We're broadcasting today from the Silicon Valley studios here in San Jose, the site of the men's regional games, where tomorrow there will be some exciting games. Cal will be playing, Oregon as well, so two West Coast teams. And we're talking this hour about the men's tournament and the women's tournament, what's appealing about both, and what's the difference between the men's and women's games. We're joined by Michelle Smith, contributor to ESPNW, and Mark Purdy, sports columnist for the San Jose Mercury News and mercurynews.com. We welcome your thoughts on the games as well. How are you doing in your brackets? Anybody pick Harvard out there? You can join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. Let's go take our first caller. We're joined first by Jennifer in Berkeley. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just have a comment about really the women's game and the men's game. I've
seen a lot of games in both areas. And it just seems like when the women are playing at the top of their game, there's a tendency to play as a team more because there's not as much one-on-one play, and there's not as much play above the rim. There's not a lot of dunking except for Brittany Griner, of course. And so there's kind of a grace and beauty in the game, and sometimes it seems like there's less ego as well. I know that John Wooden had commented on the kind of purity of the women's game for that reason. Just wanted to see what your guests thought about that.
Yeah, Jennifer, thanks for the observation. Michelle Smith.
You know, I was actually going to, as Jennifer was talking, I was thinking specifically about Coach Wooden and his quotes about the purity of the women's game. I mean, I think it's probably fairly easily argued that the women's game is a more fundamental game about basketball. The women are certainly running more half-court offense. They're running more plays. They're certainly a more coordinated effort, I think, in terms of women's basketball. There's more sharing of the ball. I think a higher premium on being able to pass and assist and things like that. I mean, I think that we all have known that's true for a lot of years. And for some folks, that's a large part of the appeal of the women's game. And frankly, for some folks, it's a drawback because they prefer to see the men and the pure athleticism and the above-the-rim game.
And what makes that game different in terms of the focus on fundamentals, passing, and all of that? Is that all about coaching? Is that what makes Tara Vanderveer such a great coach?
Well, there's a lot of men's coaches who try to teach fundamentals too. I think, and Michelle can probably help me out a little bit with this too, I'm not as familiar with like the culture of women's basketball in terms of the recruiting as I am the men. And the biggest change in the last 30 years is the development of these club team AAU programs at the high school level where they'll take the best high school players from a certain area, and all of a sudden, all summer, they're playing AAU club basketball all across the country with coaches that are not teaching fundamentals and basically are allowing these guys to become stars so they can be recruited by colleges and play, and because of the nature of that, some guys can make some trips, some can't. They can't put in any really sophisticated offense, so it kind of becomes isolation offense the whole time. And that leads to men's coaches getting these college players who are used to playing in that culture and have that mindset. I don't know. Does that happen as much in the women? I don't know. I don't know if the club teams – I know they're club teams for women – if the club teams for women are and the other thing that happens in the men's, a lot of these club programs are sponsored by shoe companies because they got dollar signs in their eyes, knowing some of these guys are going to be future NBA guys and they want to get in on the ground level. Does that happen as much in women? Do you mind if I ask the question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Does that happen as much in the women's game, Michelle?
You know, I mean, I think within the club circuit and those AAU tournaments, I think there is a certain element of showcasing your individual talent. There's coaches who are sitting on the sidelines. You've got people lined up to watch you play. And, you know, the coaches are sort of emphasizing showcase yourself, I think, a little bit. But I think by the time that those women start to filter into college, you know, they are moving into systems or they are moving into roles more frequently, I think, than some of the men's players are. I think that's pretty safe to say.
I read an interesting piece yesterday. I was just reading about different coaches, and I read this article. It was about Jennifer Azey, the former Stanford star who now coaches at USF, and her relationship with Tara Vanderveer, her former coach at Stanford. But it made a comment. Jennifer Azey was quoted in the article as saying that what matters most in terms of her recruiting and the kinds of kids she wants are the relationships, and that you have to build relationships, which seemed like an interesting observation. I don't know if you would find a men's coach necessarily. Would you, Mark Purdy, saying that what he was looking for were the kids who could form the right relationships?
Well, every coach is different. And some, you know, some coaches still, I think some coaches still want to do that. I mean, in the men's game, you know, the other thing we didn't talk about in relation to the comparison to the women's game, you know, in the men's game, there is now this conflict of some programs will and seek to recruit players that they know are no way ever going to graduate from the school.
The one and done.
But yeah. even two and done or three, you know, that, and that, how the presidents of the universities, we don't get too deep here, but how the presidents of the universities can allow that is a different issue. But at the University of Kentucky, the coach, John Calipari, there is very open about, yeah, I want these guys and I want them to come here and play for a season or two and then go to the NBA. There's no talk on the graduate. I think on the women's side, it's different. Well, and so you know you're going to have a longer lasting relationship with these players. It's a whole different dynamic.
Correct me if I'm not quite right on the statistics here, Michelle, but something like 90% of women's basketball players, college basketball players, graduate, and something like half of the teams in the tournament have like 100% graduation record, not obviously the same in the men's game.
No, and that number is probably ballpark correct. I mean, I know Pat Summitt, for everything that she accomplished at Tennessee, had a 100% graduation rate among her players for the duration of her career, which is a pretty remarkable achievement. But again, I think it goes back to what I said a little bit earlier. These women come to stay. They come to play and they come to stay. They're earning degrees because even if they are going to move on and play professional basketball overseas, or the select few of them are going to end up in the WNBA, those careers are not paying the bills. Those are salaries will get them through perhaps a few years, but they are going to have to at some point enter the job market and, you know, lead what I always tease the girls about and call it the grown-up life. They're going to have to go out and do something beyond what their athletic ability will provide for them. So these women are coming to stay and play, and I think the relationship part of it is telling. You know, Jennifer formed a very strong bond with Tara that lasts till today. They still talk on the phone. You know, Tara has said she worries about Jennifer and struggling at USF as she's rebuilding that program. The relationships in the women's game, I think, are, you know, probably more emphasized. I don't know that they're more important, but I think it's a larger part of that athlete experience in women's basketball, perhaps, than it is in men's basketball.
And I'm sheepishly going to now acknowledge, Michelle, that I think the article that I referenced about Jennifer Azey was written by you.
Yes, it was.
Let's take another call. Elizabeth joins us next in Oakland. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to, maybe the guests could comment on the best-kept secret in NCAA tournament history, and that is that the only number 16 seed to beat a number one was, in fact, Harvard. Last night was not Harvard's first-ever NCAA victory.
Oh, in the women's game.
A Harvard woman beat Stanford, who were number one, on their home floor in 1998.
And how might you happen to know about that so clearly, Elizabeth?
I'm a Harvard basketball alum. I graduated in 96, and I was in the stands, watched them beat the number one seed and really make history. But that, you know, it is frustrating that it's never mentioned. It shows sort of where women's sports are in the country's eye.
Yeah, no, thank you for joining the conversation and adding that in. Stay with us for a moment. Mark?
No, I think if Tara Vanderveer was listening, she just clicked off. Because that's and I can say last night that when at one point a number 16 seed was leading the number one seed.
Well, Gonzaga was
in a tough game. That my colleague John Wilner sitting next to me did tweet out, you know, the happiest person if Gonzaga loses will be Tara Vanderveer, because no one will reference that. So people do still think about it.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for the call. Did you cover that game, Michelle Smith?
I did. I was there that evening, and it was. And I will tell you that Tara, every year during the women's tournament, every year at some point during the tournament, that clip is rolled out, and every year Tara Vanderveer is cringing because she knows that the Harvard Stanford reference will be referenced during ESPN's coverage of the women's tournament every single year without fail, and she's never wrong. It always is.
Elizabeth, thanks again for the call. Let's go next to Bob, who joins us from Delaware. Bob, good morning.
Hi, thanks for doing this show. And Michelle, I think you probably know where I'm going to go with this conversation.
Go ahead.
University of Delaware season ticket holder. And while I agree that there's still a handful of teams in the women's program that monopolize the program, every once in a while a mid-major pops up that just is really fun to watch for a full 4 years.
Yes, Elena Deladon. Elena Deladon is one of the best players in the country, and she is playing at Delaware. And so what I would like to point out, though, is she committed to UConn directly out of high school. She was headed to Gina Auriemma's program, arrived in Connecticut during the summer to prepare for summer school, and decided after, I think it was 2 days, that she had made the wrong decision and came home and ended up playing her 4 years at Delaware. And she has certainly elevated Delaware, but she is that type of talent. I mean, she is in that breath this year with Brittany Griner, and I believe everybody thinks Deladon will be the second pick in the WNBA draft. But she is an extraordinary talent who has really pushed a mid-major small school up into the conversation among the elite programs. But, acknowledging that just doesn't happen very often because there are just not as many players like Elena Deladon out in the world as perhaps many coaches would like.
Yeah, I would also just mention that in terms of investing in the players, you know, the comments that were made earlier about investing in a four-year player and watching their progression as they go from freshmen through seniors, I do think you see a lot more of that in the women's program. And we actually have a point guard at Delaware who has played with Elena for 9 years. She transferred from George Washington University to come back to the university, and Elena did last only a short while at UConn and then didn't play her freshman year, played volleyball, and we won the conference championship. And the day after, she announced that she was ready to start playing basketball again. The other thing I wanted to mention to you real quickly is that we're hosting the NCAA tournament this weekend back here at Delaware. We have the Sunday game and the Tuesday game. And both games, both days, all four games have been sold out for weeks. We have a small venue.
Let me hold you there, Bob. I'm going to hold you there, Bob, because it leads into something I wanted to ask about, and that is the sort of the attendance and interest factor in both these tournaments. Mark Purdy, you were saying last night that the game, the Cal game in particular, was full up, mm-hmm. and I'll be curious what you find when you're covering the women's games in the days ahead, Michelle. But is interest really as high right now in college basketball as ever? Are we seeing huge amounts of interest in attending these games, both men's and women's?
Men's and women's? Well, I think the men's tournament it's become more of a TV event because of, you know, you can jump around all the games if you want. Every game's on TV now. You can change channels. They do have, in person, they do have problems selling tickets. Anybody who watched the games yesterday could see there were empty seats. Now, some of that is because you have these doubleheaders and fans of one school only come for one game and leave, then they leave the empty seats. But here in San Jose, I think one reason that Cal and Oregon were placed here is to help sell out the building. Now, they had sold all but a couple thousand tickets, I think, for this game before those were announced, but that pretty much guaranteed it. So a lot of it is, I think, the NCAA is trying to get better with the placement. Now, the women's tournament has struggled. You know, they'd like to have neutral sites like the men do, but their business model, they have decided to play these early round games on campus sites like Stanford or like Delaware to sell those tickets. I'm not that familiar with the business side of things, but just anecdotally, I think the women's game, for it to really become, I think we'll know the women's game has really reached a pinnacle or reached a milestone when they can play those first round games at neutral sites.
What is the state, Michelle Smith, of the sort of the monetary side of women's basketball right now? Do programs like Stanford, I assume UConn, Tennessee, Notre Dame, Baylor make big money, whereas USF is a big money loser?
I don't know that they make big money. I think they do make money for their universities. They contribute to the in the black in the athletic department. But I think that there are not a ton of those programs around the country. I think that the majority of women's programs take more from their athletic department budget than they probably contribute in terms of ticket sales. There are not a lot of places where they're drawing regularly in the four figures. There are some schools and some conferences that do very well with that. The Big 12 down in the Midwest and in the South, they have very good attendance for their women's basketball and some historically very good teams. But women's basketball as a draw at some of the smaller schools, you know, these women are still playing during the regular season in front of a few hundred fans. The brief history of the women's tournament in terms of placement of sites is, you know, I think they've tried a little bit of everything at this point. It used to be that if you drew one of the top four seeds in each region, you were automatically designated the host, and you had a host site, which gave a tremendous advantage to the home teams. And people felt
Except
it was
Stanford
skewing the
in
tournament.
1998 against Harvard, right?
It did, exactly, yes. Which made the fact that Harvard beat them, I mean, the upset was big enough, but to do it on Stanford's home floor, I mean, you know, sort of raises the level. But now they've reached a bit of they've tried neutral sites, and, you know, the ticket sales didn't go particularly well because fans weren't traveling. So they've tried a bit of a hybrid. Schools now bid 2 years in advance for the right to host. So Stanford bid 2 years ago for the right to host games, frankly, knowing that they would almost assuredly be playing in those games. And this year, as it turns out, in 15 of the 16 host sites for these first and second round games, 15 of the teams are in the tournament, which is creating a different situation for the women, which is you've got a team like Iowa, who's a number 8 seed, who put in a bid to host, will be hosting Notre Dame, a number 1 seed. So Notre Dame's going to have to play on Iowa's home floor. And competitively, there are some folks that have big issues with that. And I would say probably number 1 of them would be the Notre Dame coach.
Yeah. And of course, Notre Dame has one of the great women's players playing today, and Skylar Diggins, really an exciting player to watch.
But shorter answer is, I think TV carries the freight probably for both these tournaments.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where the big money is. And, you know, the attendance is a nice studio show to put on.
Let's hear next from Christina here in San Jose. Christina, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks. So just going off of what you guys are talking about, I was a Division I athlete for 4 years at San Jose State. And, you know, coming from a smaller school that's actually a commuter school, the attendance for both men and women at times was pretty scarce, just because a lot of people are driving to school. They're not living, you know, on campus or right around the corner. So it really depends on the location of the school and the team spirit, because, you know, when we were playing those heavier games where it was a bigger sense of rivalry and a lot more at stake, the attendance was much larger. And you got to look at the teams too. You have a smaller, younger team, you're going to have younger fans. So, you know, it's going to attract a different atmosphere. But a lot goes into the whole aspect of who's playing, how you're doing in the season, and who you're attracting to these games.
Christina, what did you take from your experience as a college athlete at San Jose State?
Basketball-wise, I was an athlete, and so I knew all of these guys who were playing, and they're all really great guys, and we understand athletically what goes into being a Division I athlete. Granted, we may not be that Baylor or that Kentucky or the Harvard, but we do sacrifice so much for our teams that it's hard not to have that passion for those that are out on the court, you know, and for even if you're not able to go to a game and support them, you're still texting them like, hey, how'd you do with the game last night? Heard you guys did really well, or sorry you guys lost. But there's definitely a big sense of pride that goes along amongst the athletes.
Christina, thanks. Thanks for joining our conversation today. I'm always struck by the fact that at the Stanford men's games, the Stanford women's team is almost always there cheering them on. So there is that kind of camaraderie and relationship. San Jose State struggled in basketball on the men's side, just fired their coach. How hard is it to develop a program? And is it, in the end, just about finding the right coach, as they did, San Jose State did in football ever so briefly, perhaps?
Yeah, it's a complex deal. You know, I'm old enough. I actually covered the San Jose team that last played in the NCAA tournament, and that, I can tell you how that happened, was just kind of a weird, I don't know, set of events where they ended up with a guy, Olivier Saint-Jean, who came here from France, and eventually became a pretty good NBA player, changed his name to Tariq Abdul-Wahad. And he showed up on campus, and they found a couple other guys that could play with him. They had a coach, Stan Morrison, who knew how to do X's and O's. And just for that one season, it all kind of came together at the end at the conference tournament. And they won the conference tournament, went and got hammered by Kentucky in the first round. But that's the only time San Jose State's made the NCAA men's tournament since I've worked in San Jose. And seeing that, it was almost, I don't know, I don't want to say by accident, but they haven't been able to repeat anything close to that. I think it does take a commitment by a university for facilities, and I think Michelle could probably speak to this. I think not enough universities have made enough, even this day and age, enough of a commitment to women's programs. They can say they're parity, but if you're not, you know, Michelle can probably talk about this better than I can, but the reason I think that the women's program does not have greater parity is because more schools do not want to commit. I don't know, it's little things like academic support and stuff, or big things. And, you know, in men's, because the money is so much greater, even as we had St. Mary's actually go on NCAA probation this year because they're chasing that. And I think that embarrassed that school up there. You don't want that, but it shows you, in a weird way, the emphasis they were putting on it.
What are the challenges for a Jennifer Azey at USF, Michelle Smith? I mean, can that be turned around? Is that mission impossible?
You know, I mean, I think building a program is difficult. I think when you make a coaching change, no matter who you bring in, they are going to need some time, because as much as I do think it's about hiring the right coach, it is absolutely about players. Tar Vandiver will tell you that Stanford hasn't won a national championship since 1992. They are chasing, they are chasing to get that back. They went 12 years without going to a Final Four, and then, she recruited a great player in Candace Wiggins, and recruiting a great player in Candace Wiggins got her Jane Appel, which got her NECA Ogumike, which brought in her sister Chinee. You have to have players in order to achieve at these highest levels. And for Jennifer Azey, somebody at USF, she has to talk the players that are a fit for her program. And I think we talk about fit in the women's game a lot more than we talk about it in the men's game. But she's looking for players who fit her program to come in, and she's looking for diamonds in the rough. She is at those AAU tournaments searching perhaps for someone who she sees something in that maybe another coach doesn't see. But it's a bit of a chemical process to sort of put the pieces together to get you to the point. And somebody like Jennifer, it's interesting, the contrast. Jennifer is chasing to get into the top two or three spots in her conference to possibly have a shot at getting into the NCAA tournament, while her mentor, Tara, is chasing the top players in the country, trying to get back to Final Four so that they can win a national championship for the first time in 20 years. I mean, it's a very, the range of the kind of, where you are with your programs is huge.
Let's spend our last few minutes just talking about the games you're both going to be following. I asked you for storylines earlier, but are there particular games that draw your interest for some reason, whether it's the coaching storyline, whether it's players, whether it's a feel-good story, whether it's a possible upset? I don't know what kind of shape your brackets are in at the moment, Mark Purdy, but is there something that you're keeping a particularly close eye on?
Well, actually, you and I, in the break here, we're talking about a game today that really intrigues me, Wisconsin against Ole Miss. Wisconsin is this, like a lot of Big Ten teams, their players look like more like football players, and they play this really stultified offense and strong defense, and want to win games 55-54, maybe. And the Ole Miss is this wild and crazy team with this one wild and crazy player named Crawford, I think his name is, and he, if he touches the ball, he's shooting it. He taunts players, the other teams. I mean, it's just exactly the opposite. I love that contrast. So I'm looking forward to that game. And then, I want to see this, the Syracuse, actually both these games tomorrow. St. Louis, Oregon is really going to be intriguing. That whole storyline with St. Louis, but also the way they play. They have a very savvy senior point guard who's kind of an old salt, and Oregon's guards are these young, quick kids. And I'm looking forward to that match.
And a really good coach in Dana Albin.
Yes.
And does Cal have a chance against Syracuse?
Sure, Cal has a chance. I mean, if Mike Montgomery has their full attention, I know him enough to know he's already thought about this game. As soon as the bracket was announced. He had somebody on his staff getting a Syracuse game plan ready 2 days ago, in case. And so, and the fact that he's old friends with Syracuse coach Jim Boeheim, and Montgomery was joking last night that, Mike Montgomery was at Stanford, plus played almost strictly man-for-man defense. Now at Cal, because of the players he's got, yesterday he played mostly zone, and Boeheim is famous for playing zone defense as being kind of master zone defense. And Mike Montgomery used to tease Jim Boeheim, saying, and your players play in skirts too, because, that's not – there we go with the sexist joke, Michelle. But that it's not a manly man thing supposed to do to play zone defense. And now you're going to see these two guys play zone defenses against each other.
And Michelle, how about you? What are you going to be following in the days ahead?
I think the women's tournament this year is all about the stars. I think that's actually kind of good for the women's game, and that I think that some of these ladies will be able to sort of poke through into the mainstream sports consciousness in the next few weeks. But, you know, I think we know in the women's tournament we have a pretty good sense of who is going to be there at the end. It is going to be Baylor. It will be Notre Dame. It likely would be a team like Connecticut. Stanford has a very good chance of reaching a sixth straight Final Four, which would be an NCAA record. But this is about Brittany Griner and the 6'8 player from Baylor, who is just an extraordinary talent in the women's game that we haven't seen maybe ever in terms of her size and the things she can do. Skylar Diggins at Notre Dame, Elena Deladon at Delaware. We'll see how far Delaware can push into this tournament. Even Chinne Ogumike at Stanford. This tournament, I think, for the women is going to be all about the big names. But I think in this case it's very good for the women's game because there's a chance to really get into the national sports consciousness over the next 3 weeks.
We have to wrap things up, but I want to let Anna get in one quick word because you've been waiting patiently on hold. Just about 20 seconds left, Anna. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks. So mostly I want to just thank you for including women's basketball in this conversation. Also love having Michelle Smith on, who's actually an incredible softball player but has become an amazing ESPN commentator. And I played basketball for a junior college at Escada State Championships in the late 80s. And once a player, always a fan, and I just appreciate the conversation.
All right, Anna, thanks, and thanks, and I'm sure Michelle appreciates that plug for her softball expertise. Thanks both so much. I'm eager to get off the air here shortly and go find out how Wisconsin is doing. You have to love a team that features a player named Dan Brusewitz.
Is he the kid with the red hair?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark Purdy of the San Jose Mercury and Mercury.com, thanks so much, and Michelle Smith of ESPNW. Thanks both very much for being part of our program. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Dan Zoll and Howard Gelman are our engineers today. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.